Have you heard about an agent in depression recovery or you're reading that can actually improve the mental performance of normal, healthy people? The single agent that we're talking about. Here's some other characteristics we'll look at in a minute, but this compound is called brain-derived neurotrophic factor. How many of you are getting bored because you know all about this? Okay, I see most of you looking still somewhat interested. This is good. BDNF, that's the abbreviation for this amazing compound. Not only can it improve cognitive or mental health function in normal people, it has actually been shown to help with addictive behaviors. If you know someone who's dealing with alcohol abuse, did you know if you can improve their BDNF levels, they will have an easier time breaking free of alcohol? But that's not all. It has appetite suppressant effects. Now, some of you, if you're looking at me, you're saying, well, Dr. DeRose, you don't need BDNF. It looks like you could probably put on a little bit of weight. Well, someone told me that you're having lunch here, so I'll stay by, unless you tell me I'm not welcome. And, I am? Okay, good. I'm relieved. So, the point is, though, many Americans are struggling with what? Obesity and other eating issues, overeating issues. BDNF can help by suppressing appetite. There's other benefits to this compound. It has been shown to prevent, like I said to begin with, a host of neurodegenerative disorders. One of them is Alzheimer's disease. You can decrease your risk of Alzheimer's if you raise levels of BDNF in your brain. Parkinson's disease. That's a scary one. No one likes to get that diagnosis. Alzheimer's, if you get the diagnosis when it's far advanced, you don't care. Yeah, but Parkinson's often does not cause dementia initially. It can cause dementia as well, but often movement disorders and other problems can lose your ability to speak, even losing your ability to eat as Parkinson gets very advanced. Ischemic stroke. How many of you know the two main categories of stroke? I see some of you nodding your heads. There's what we call a hemorrhagic stroke. That's a bleeding stroke. But then there's the ischemic or thrombotic stroke. What does that mean in plain English? That's when you have a blockage in a blood vessel going to the brain. So hemorrhagic stroke is one of those brain blood vessels bursts. Maybe you have an aneurysm, a ballooning out of the vessel, and then it ruptures. That would be a hemorrhagic stroke, commonly seen in people with high blood pressure. Ischemic stroke is stroke caused by blockage in the blood vessels. You can actually decrease your risk of ischemic stroke by raising what in your brain? BDNF. By the way, one of the answers to many of the questions I'll ask in this presentation is BDNF. Okay? Just a word to the wise. And then depression. Yes. That's why I was wondering, does Dr. Nedley snuck this into the current series? Does he talk about BDNF at all? Very little? Okay. Well, we'll spend more time with it. So this is good. So we're complementing stuff you already know. If you'd already heard it, it would be a good review for you because this is such an important compound. It's not just an antidepressant. It helps you with these other problems and improves brain health in healthy people. Now, I don't have any inside track to the pharmaceutical industry. But drug companies, I'm sure, are hot on the trail of BDNF. I'm sure they're trying to come out with some pill that can raise BDNF levels in your brain. The problem is you can't take it by mouth. It's a protein, so it would be destroyed in the acid of your stomach. Besides that, even if you can get it into the blood, it's got to get into the brain, and there's something called the blood-brain barrier. So it's not easy to raise levels of this with drug therapy. In fact, there is no known drug that I have any awareness of that can raise BDNF levels. So you say, okay, drug companies can't do it, can't take a pill for it, what can I do? Well, the good news is the scientific research is showing us that there's at least three lifestyle strategies that can raise levels of this compound. I know some of you are already saying, oh no. That's all we've been hearing about here. Now another three lifestyle therapies. Well, hopefully the lifestyle therapies we look at are already ones that you've gotten excited about for other reasons. Wouldn't that be good news? So I'm not having to add three more things that now you're going to have to do. Well, let's just see what those three things are. How do we naturally optimize BDNF? Well, here's the first one. It's actually dietary restriction. We'll talk about each of these in some detail. I'm just going to give you an overview. Dietary restriction. Second one is regular physical exercise. Third one, environmental enrichment or stimulation. We'll talk about that. And then there is a fourth one that I think there's good evidence for, and that is avoiding alcohol. So we'll look at all of these in some detail in our time together. Now let me give you a few disclaimers, because I just put up a list there. And the danger is some of your minds are already running. Okay, Grandpa has Parkinson's disease. See, it's because he ate too much. Okay? Or, you know what, that neighbor has Alzheimer's. It's because they didn't exercise. Well, here's the problem. Any of those diseases that we've talked about doesn't mean, the presence of them doesn't mean a person was not on a good lifestyle. You see, the danger of speaking about lifestyle and its connection with health is there is a subtle tendency to point fingers when we learn about lifestyle-related diseases. Are you following along with me? So you can learn about these connections, and then you'll say, oh, Dr. DeRosa has Parkinson's disease. Oh, my. Well, I don't right now. No, you don't know the future. But if I came down with Parkinson's, what would you might be tempted to say? Well, he was telling us how to prevent it. He obviously was, you know, probably having a little alcohol on the side, and he'd act like he was, you know, into fitness, and, you know, we'd see him running around or something, but probably most of the time he's just watching television. And you get my picture, right? So the message of lifestyle is not to give us ammunition to judge other people. It's to help us focus on a healthier lifestyle ourselves and share that enthusiasm with other people. Okay? So don't forget that. So a person can still follow an excellent lifestyle and can come down with any of these conditions. Let me just tell you one thing about genetics if you haven't heard it already. It's simply this. Every one of us got dealt a genetic hand, if you will, right? How many of you chose what genetics you would have? No. None of us chose that. So here's the issue. Let's say in your family, you got dealt the gene for Parkinson's. Now, I'm not saying it necessarily any of these things are a single gene, but let's just say, hypothetically, it is. And so you have the gene for Parkinson's. But you can modify your risk by your lifestyle. So if you get on a healthy lifestyle, you might not come down with Parkinson's till you're 65. You say, 65? That's awfully young. But you know, if you had that same genetic background and you were following the average American lifestyle, you may have had the diagnosis at 35. You see the difference? I just had a patient in my office the other day. And she was there, a very health-conscious woman, about 60 years of age, recently diagnosed with breast cancer. And she was saying, I was so careful with my diet and everything. And we talked about this, because whether it's breast cancer or Parkinson's or Alzheimer's, there's genetic factors, whether it's stroke or heart attack. All of these things, there are genetic factors that predispose you to certain conditions. Some of those conditions you can totally avoid with a healthy lifestyle. But if you get dealt a bad enough genetic hand, I'll just be honest with you. Some of you have seen a very good film called Forks Over Knives. Have you heard about that? And in that film, in so many words, Dr. Esselstyn says that basically no one needs to die of heart disease. It's not a good lifestyle. Well, it's really not true. There was a girl who had a heart attack when she was 8 or 10 years of age. 8 or 10 years of age. How bad do you think her lifestyle was to have a heart attack at 8 or 10? No, she wasn't on a terrible lifestyle. It was that she had terrible genes. Her cholesterol was like 800 or 1,000. Very unusual. But there was no lifestyle that this girl was going to follow that was going to... It was a problem, actually, with her liver. What she ended up needing as a young girl was a heart and liver transplant in order to survive. So my point is simply this. If the genetic hand is bad enough, it doesn't matter what you do. The disease cannot be fully averted, but you can delay its arrival. So, this is what we're talking about, preserving or lengthening disease-free interval. Now, you might say, this is very depressing, Dr. DeRose. We've been coming to all these lectures. They've been telling us about how to prevent disease. Now, you're telling me that it's possible that I could still die from something anyway. Yeah, that's true. You know, we're here in a church, so we can, you know, give you the full information. And that is, barring Jesus' soon return, all of us are going to die from something, right? And it's not necessarily that we're going to all just die crossing the street getting hit by a car at, you know, 110 years of age, not the miles per hour that the car was driving. You understand? Okay. Although that's pretty bad, too. But the point I'm simply making is we don't know. You say, but everyone in my family had a heart attack in their 40s. But you know what? Actually, this was another patient I had recently, and they were telling me something like that. They said, I was supposed to only live to 45. I'm in my 60s. And what they were saying is that they had these really bad genes, but what had they done? They had focused on their lifestyle. So the message is, let's get real serious about what we can do to improve BDNF levels, but let's not judge anyone else just because they have a problem. So let's go on and talk about these four elements and give you a little bit of detail. First, we're going to talk about dietary restriction. What is that talking about? How many of you think this looks like an excellent breakfast? I see some of you looking perplexed, and others say, I don't know. That looks pretty meager, doesn't it? By the way, we don't advocate a breakfast this small. But I'm trying to make a point here. We're talking about eating less. Now, this again, this is not the... no one's going to be policing you at lunch and making sure you just have... I didn't figure out the calories on this, but maybe this is, just a guess, maybe around 100 calories. I'm just guessing looking at it. So you say, boy, that's a pretty meager fare. All of us, just about, probably all of us in this room would die sticking with a 300-calorie diet, 100 calories like this at each meal, if you eat three meals a day. We would be in a negative caloric balance. Some of us might last a little bit longer than others, but all of us would end up dying of malnutrition. So this is not the message. But what is the message is this. Fascinating data, if you haven't heard it. If you look at the research on BDNF, or if you look at the research on longevity, they're coming to the same conclusion. If you cut back on your caloric intake, you actually live longer. You live longer. And the theory with BDNF is this. If you are putting your brain into a caloric deficit, if you're not giving your brain as many calories as it would like to have, you're putting a mild stress on your brain. Now you say, well, wait a minute. Stress. How many of you think stress is good? Okay, there's a few of you brave souls raising your hands. Okay, some more of you getting brave because others have raised their hands. Or maybe you were taking notes on your computer and didn't have a hand free. Here's the interesting thing. Although we usually label stress as bad, all of us on some level understand that moderate stress is actually good. If I was a doctor and I said, I'm going to put you on... I am a doctor, by the way. Okay, but if I was going to put you on a no physical stress program, what would be the least physically stressful program I could put you on? Yes, bed rest. That's right. Now, how many of you think that would be conducive to good health? No. Bed rest? Just laying in bed? What happens if you just lay in bed? You atrophy. Your muscles waste away. So some people pay good money to go see trainers. Now, I've heard rumors that there are actually some trainers in this room and their price is very reasonable. Is that true? By the way, do you still have openings? Is it too late if someone needs a personal trainer? Some of you are trainers up here? Okay. So they still have openings. And how much do you charge? I know this maybe isn't the appropriate venue for that, but is it affordable to most people?
How much is it?
Free.
Now, the reason why these quality trainers can give you free training is I understand they're in training themselves, all right? So they're part of their educational program, and they've got experienced trainers looking over their shoulders, so they're not going to tell you to do anything wild. Like, if you've been at bed rest for the last, 5 years, they're not going to tell you to run a marathon tomorrow. Okay, you understand, right? You guys, know all those basics. So here's the point. People spend good money or good time to see, free trainers. What do those trainers do usually? They actually stress them. Have you thought about this? They stress them physically. So, do you get the picture? If you go to the health club and you're working with a trainer there, what are they going to do? They're going to say, okay, I want to meet with... Now listen, I want you to go home and rest some more. Is that what they tell you? What do they do? When you go see the trainer in the health club, what do? Let's get to work. Okay. So they're going to make you work. They're going to stress you. Whatever terminology you want to use, you've got it. They want to stress you. And so, why do you do it? Because you know that moderate stress strengthens your muscles. It's the same with your brain. You say, but Dr. DeRosa, I don't like that. I just like to, sit with my beer and pizza and watch television. Well, that may feel good because that's what you're used to, but you need a little bit more stress if you want to have optimal brain function. Well, the way we do that is by caloric restriction. So you say, how much is it going to take? Well, in one primate model, they found that you had to cut your daily caloric intake about 30%. In order to raise BDNF levels. Now, this is no problem for most Americans because we're eating too much. Okay? Now, there's always a danger in talking about this. There's likely someone in here, that's barely holding on to, weighing, they're like have a BMI of, 17. That's really low. They're really thin. And they're going to be the ones that get really serious about this. They say, well, I heard Dr. DeRose, and instead of having, two apples for breakfast with my oatmeal, I'm going to cut down to one, and I'm going to cut my bowl of oatmeal in half. And in fact, if this person is really not feeling all that good, they saw my graphic and they said, they took a picture of it with their smartphone or their tablet, and they're going to say, this is the picture, Dr. DeRose, so how many Cheerios are here? And they're going to count them all. 27 Cheerios. I think there were 5 almonds and a couple of, how much of the apple is that? Do you understand what I'm saying? Yes, you can go to extremes with anything. But most of us are eating too much. Let's just do this exercise. I'm even going to take a little math. I know it's early in the day. But let's say someone is eating 3 meals a day. Okay, some people actually do that, right? 3 meals a day. And let's just say eating those 3 meals a day, equal calories at each meal. You got the hypothetical scenario? How many meals would they have to leave off to cut their caloric intake about 30%? Excellent. Good. I'm glad I didn't challenge you too much early in the day. So they'd have to cut back one meal. If you were going to leave off one meal a day to improve your BDNF levels, which one do you think would be the best meal to leave off? That's right. It's the evening meal. By the way, what we know from research on metabolism, if you're trying to lose weight, the calories that most tend to stick around the middle are the calories you eat late in the day. You say, well, that's Dr. DeRosa, that's why I make sure I finish my supper by 8:30 p.m. That's actually too late. In the research, there was actually a fascinating study some years ago, you may have heard of it in some of your other sessions, but they found that people who finished their last meal of the day by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, no matter what food choices they made, they lost weight. Okay? So I understand that lunch will be served here today well before 3. So that's good. That's why I don't like lecturing for evening dinner programs. Sometimes it happens. We usually selectively then choose our topics. Okay, more good news about eating less. I mentioned this already. In animal models, dietary restriction is one of the most consistent things found to extend lifespan. Let's just stop and talk about that for a minute. Let's say you have a pet rat. and you feed the pet rat 20% less than it would choose to eat otherwise, what does the research show? How much longer will that pet rat live? 20% longer. That's exactly right. How about if you cut its calories back 30%? How much longer will it live? That's exactly right. 30% longer. How about if you cut its calories back 99%? Yeah, it will die early from malnutrition. Okay, I mean, yeah, there's a point of diminishing returns. But here's the point. It almost seems like in the current environment in which we live, we're designed, we're programmed to process so many calories and then die. So you shouldn't say, oh boy, am I lucky. I feel so sorry for that brother of mine because he's got to watch every calorie he eats. I can just eat whatever I want and I don't have a weight problem. This is actually not good. Based on the research, you are hastening your mortality. You say, Dr. Droz, you can't hasten your mortality. Mortality is what we all have. All you can do is hasten the day that you die. Make it come sooner. Well, whatever terminology you want to use, you get my point. So overeating is a problem even if you're not overweight. Well, if you were wondering about this, sometimes I talk about the subject of hemorheology, and that's another fascinating subject. I do a series called Longevity Plus, where we speak about this. This is blood fluidity. And the point simply is that dietary restriction improves BDNF levels. Who remembers what that stands for? That's right, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. If you slipped in a little bit late, that's what we're talking about, this health-enhancing compound that improves brain health. Let's review, just to make sure we're all on the same page. Why are we talking about what good can BDNF do for you if you raise its levels in your brain? It can help with addictive behaviors if you have addictions, including food addiction. If you're an overeater, BDNF can help you with that. What else can it help you with? Alzheimer's decreases your risk of Alzheimer's disease. What else can it do? Can help you lose weight. That's exactly right. Anything else? Okay, good question. There's different types of fat, and some fat is more metabolically active than others. BDNF, to my knowledge, doesn't actually impact the fat. It's actually working directly on the brain. And I'm glad you asked the question because I didn't, with this group, really define BDNF maybe as clearly as we should have. Let me just break the term down. BDNF stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. Let's just look at the word. Neurotrophic, that third word in the term. Neuro refers to nerve or brain cells. What does trophic refer to? Growth, that's right. A trophic factor is a growth factor. So a neurotrophic factor is a factor that helps the brain cells grow, helps the health of the brain cells. So it's not working on the fat or the muscle. It's not revving up your mitochondria, which are the powerhouses of the cell. I mean, a number of those things can help you with weight loss and other things. But BDNF is brain-derived. What does that mean? Brain-derived. That's right. Your brain makes it. And what we're telling you is there's four things you can do to help your brain make more of it. So brain-derived neurotrophic factor is this natural factor your brain makes that helps preserve the health of your brain. And what we're finding is one of the things that can improve that is eating less. Now, some of you might think, well, Dr. DeRose, maybe you got an intelligence report and they told you, listen, we don't have enough food for lunch today. We really need you to, you know, talk about caloric restriction. So when people go through the line at lunch, they'll just take a little bit. No one's given me that intelligence report, and I'm assuming there's going to be plenty of food for lunch, but we still want to be careful that we don't overeat. Well, if you have arthritis or other inflammatory conditions, caloric restriction, just to let you know, has also been shown to lower levels of all these common inflammatory compounds. You say, common? I've never heard of interleukins or tumor necrosis factor. Well, they're common because all of us have these compounds in our bodies. If you're not aware of it, the strongest drugs today used for autoimmune diseases work on these compounds. So if you're taking an injection for rheumatoid arthritis, if you have inflammatory bowel disease, if you have some other severe autoimmune condition, maybe you've got a mixed connective tissue disease, maybe you have scleroderma, you may be getting injections with compounds that lower levels of things like tumor necrosis factor and the interleukins. But I'm simply saying to you that caloric restriction itself can lower these levels. By the way, this is one of the reasons why fasting is so powerful. It's because it depresses these inflammatory compounds. Well, this is some research that came out of what used to be called Mount Sinai School of Medicine. It's now called the Icahn School of Medicine. I guess is it Carl Icahn that donated a large amount of money to the School of Medicine? You know, many of you know that name if you follow business circles at all. And so it's now called the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, if I'm not mistaken. Anyway, there's a research group there that looks at brain health, and I want to just read their conclusions. It's now widely accepted that if the onset of the disease, they're speaking of Alzheimer's disease, could be delayed by even 5 years, the incidence could be cut in half. Now, what does this mean in plain English? What it means in plain English is, let's ask a question. When do people get Alzheimer's disease? Typically. That's right, later in life, I heard someone say. So let's say Alzheimer's disease comes knocking at your door. Let's say we knew, we read a book that had your future in it, and it says when you get to be 95, Alzheimer's disease will come knocking on your door. And you say, oh, well, I'm going to probably die before then. I don't have to worry about it. Well, there are some people I know in this room who are older than 95. Okay? So here's the point. You may live that long. So you say, okay, well, what can I do? Well, here's the point. Let's say we knew that you were going to get Alzheimer's at 95, but you were going to die at 99. So you say, well, if I could just delay the arrival of Alzheimer's by 5 years, what would happen? You'd never get it. And so this is the idea. We're not going to talk about it here, but in preventive medicine, we talk about something called compression of morbidity. And the idea is, I said we wouldn't talk about it, but I'll just give it to you in a nutshell. The idea is that even if you're predisposed genetically to disease, if you could stave it off long enough, you'd either not get it, or maybe when you turned 110, all these diseases would come, you know, raining down on you, and you'd just die overnight. Because, you know, all the kidney disease, the Alzheimer's, the stroke, the heart attack, the cancer that you were predisposed to, would all finally, on your 110th birthday, just come down on you and you would just die overwhelmed by it. Isn't that better than getting the kidney disease at 40 and the heart disease at 50? You get the point? So we may have these genetic predispositions, but lifestyle can make a difference. That's what the researchers are saying. So now let's follow along with their logic. Both clinical and epidemiologic evidence. Clinical evidence is what we do in research studies. Epidemiological evidence is looking at population groups. They're saying this suggests to us that modifying lifestyle factors, changing lifestyle factors such as what? Nutrition may prove crucial to Alzheimer's disease management, given the mounting evidence that the brain cells are remarkably responsive to what? What someone's doing. What they're saying is your brain is malleable. It's moldable. You can shape your brain by the lifestyle choices you make. And many of you know that. You say, we've been coming to the Depression Recovery Program. We've got that message. Well, here's what they said. They're starting now to talk about what? Caloric restriction. That's why we're looking at this. Caloric intake is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. So if you're eating a lot of calories, especially, they said, if they come from saturated fat, it's going to promote the changes in the brain that go along with Alzheimer's disease. That's technically what they're talking about, Alzheimer's disease type beta amyloidosis. So they're saying what foods are especially bad? Saturated fat. Where do you find saturated fat? Okay, you find it, yes, that's right, in animal fats. So those French fries that they cooked in the lard are going to be loaded with saturated fat. The steak. You say, but Dr. DeRose, when I have steak, I cut all the fat off it. Do you know if you had low-fat steak, most people would, if they ordered it at the restaurant, they'd say, take this away, this is terrible. Because low-fat meat is very tough. What makes meat tender is fat that's running through the tissues. You cannot trim the fat out of standard meat. You can take the fat off the edges, sure. But there's fat, the meat is what we call marbleized. It's full of fat, and the cattle raising practices. Now, someone said that they were very interested in cattle today in Lincoln. I'm not sure what the history behind that is. But who can tell me about this? Why are they having this cattle run today? Was this originally a cattle town? Oh, they're celebrating the renovation of the streets with a cattle run. What is it? It is still a big cattle town. Okay. So folks here, if you're a cattle rancher, you're saying, well, Dr. DeRose, I'm still going to eat my meat. Well, remember, the message is not, I'm not saying you can't eat meat. Now, you may come to that conclusion. I've come to that conclusion that that was a better strategy. But I don't tell people they can't eat meat. But what I do tell them, especially when we're looking at brain health, is the less you eat, the better. The less saturated fat you consume, the better for your brain health. What about ice cream? Well, the average ice cream has a healthy amount or an unhealthy amount of saturated fat. Okay? Most things that have a creamy or fatty texture have a large amount of fat. And if they're from animal sources, that fat is almost always saturated fat. So another high saturated fat food would be cheese. Okay? So animal products in general would be the main sources of saturated fat in the American diet. You say, Dr. DeRose, I'm so glad because I'm a vegetarian. I went to Dr. DeRose's lectures. I'm coming to the cooking classes here. They're teaching me to be a vegetarian. I've gotten rid of all those animal products. So now I can eat whatever I want. Well, here's the reminder. You can't just eat all you want of everything. You say, well, wait a minute. That's what they said in that program. They said I could eat all I want. Well, really, no program is telling you you should be a glutton, okay? Really? You can eat too much, even of healthy foods. And even excessive carbohydrate intake can increase your risk of these conditions like Alzheimer's. Now, if you want to bring this all together, again, these same researchers there in New York City, if you are overweight and have diabetes, you over quadruple your risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. Okay, so these things are all interrelated. Well, we need to hasten on and talk with you because some of you are getting discouraged. You're saying, Dr. DeRose, I feel like the woman in the picture there. Others of you may feel like the man there. Some of you may remember those figures from Barnum's Circus years ago. But these are two real people. And some have suggested that one of them had mastered this principle and the other hadn't. The most powerful weight control principle, eating to satisfy hunger, not eating to try to satisfy appetite. Now, what does that mean? What it means is you can educate your brain to know when your hunger is satisfied. That is a true physiologic need for food. But most of us have learned to eat when we're not hungry. I got lessons in this when I was a small boy. Because something would happen, or I'd go over to my friend's house, maybe I just had lunch, and what would my friend offer me? He'd offer me something to eat, and what would I do? I'd eat, and I'd be at school. Maybe I just had breakfast, or maybe I just had lunch. But it's Johnny's birthday! And so what did Johnny bring for his birthday? That's right, he brought something to eat. Whether it's cupcakes or cookies or cake. And so what would they do? They'd give cake to all the students in the class. And so we're educated in our culture to eat when? When we're not hungry. And so most of us have lost the ability to differentiate. If we were doing a whole seminar, we'd talk more about it. But some of you are keeping close to some of these trainers. They can fill you in. And if not, they can watch some of my videos and figure out what I talk about on that subject. But let's move on. And hasten over to this topic, periodic fasting. Periodic fasting. So we've told you that if you cut back calories on a daily basis, you will raise BDNF levels. So it is with periodic fasting. We've told you there is a meal not to skip because breakfast, that meal is very important. It's very important for longevity. That's what the research shows us. And in some of the data, it is as important to eat breakfast as it is. You see it here. You see it, right? Maybe it's in the next slide. Yeah, this is the one. More important or equally important to eat breakfast as it is not to smoke or to get regular physical exercise. So as we get older, the research indicates that you should eat a regular breakfast, not just be a non-smoker, not just exercise. But Dr. DeRose, we heard that exercise was the single most important thing we can do for our health. Well, I'm not saying that there isn't some data that shows that, but as we get older, if you are in your 60s and you're still smoking, it already shows that genetically you are better able to handle those 7,000 chemicals in cigarette smoke than the average person. Are you aware that they've identified 7,000 chemicals in cigarette smoke? Now, if you're not yet 60, you should quit. If you are in your 60s, you still should quit because you still get benefit from stopping smoking. But here's the point. Don't pat yourself on the back saying, well, I'm not smoking and I'm on an exercise program now, but I hate breakfast. How many of you would believe that this woman is 110 years old because she eats regular breakfast? How many would believe that? It could be true. I don't have no idea how old she is. I don't know anything about her lifestyle practices. Okay? But the point is, it's a longevity factor that raises levels of BDNF. Let's move on now to exercise, regular physical exercise. Extremely important. It doesn't matter what kind of exercise you're doing, it can help you raise BDNF levels. And regular exercise, you know, you've heard a lot about it in this very venue, can improve brain function. It can do a number of things, can help the brain bounce back from injury better too. So we don't want to spend a lot of time with this, but let me just show you. If you exercise and BDNF levels can boost something like 30% after exercise. The more intense the exercise, the better the BDNF rise. Now, I don't recommend intense exercise unless you're working with a health professional, because for some people that's dangerous. Just do something every day, and that will help you improve your BDNF levels. By the way, it will also help you deal with stress. For some of you, this lecture is quite stressful. So you want to get out and exercise. Okay? Maybe I should mention this to you. There's a compound called corticosterone. Maybe you've heard of cortisol. All in the same family. What this does, this is a stress hormone. It tends to decrease BDNF levels. And then, in addition to that, it leads to atrophy of a region in the brain called the hippocampus. That is a part of the brain that is involved in memory formation. So what I'm trying to help you see here is exercise directly raises BDNF, but exercise also helps you control stress better. And so you want to be physically active. That is one of the best things you can do for your memory and for your brain. So, like I said, exercise can help the brain in and of itself. But since you've had a lot on exercise, we're going to hasten on to the next one, which is environmental enrichment or stimulation. Environmental enrichment or stimulation. You say, well, what is that? What is environmental enrichment? What is environmental stimulation? Well, right now, believe it or not, you should all be environmentally enriched. Because I doubt any of you live in this building. Does anyone live right here? Sleep on these pews? So what you've done is you've come into a different environment today. Now, some of you got this message about the cattle run, and I understand some of you got the message, or some, I shouldn't say of you, but some who often come to this meeting got the message, and they said, a cattle run, Dr. DeRose speaking, cattle run, I'm going to the cattle run, okay? So I know some aren't here because of that. Others of you said, well, this sounds stressful. I mean, it's going to be a problem. I don't know if I even want to come, but some of you braved it anyway. I mean, it's, you know, crowds of people and you're trying to find a parking place. Well, challenge in the environment is actually what we're talking about. So anything that calls you out of your comfort zone is environmentally enriching. I just actually got a call as we were driving in.
Some of you know I host a weekly radio show. That's a whole other story. I've been doing it for about a dozen years. If you haven't heard of it, it's called American Indian Living. They say, Dr. DeRose, you don't look Native American. I'm actually not, but I lived for many years in Oklahoma, and I had a radio background even before I went into medicine, and so I was asked to host this show over a dozen years ago. So I'm scheduled to be, actually within a day or so, on my way to San Diego for the National Congress of American Indians. This is the largest political gathering of Native Americans. It takes place this time every year. And I'm typically there recording radio shows. So we'll have a booth in the exhibit area, and we're interviewing tribal leaders and things for this radio show. It's a health-focused show, but it's health issues especially of interest to Native Americans. And by the way, if any of you have Native American blood, you realize that the health concerns of American Indians are the same as anyone else. So, okay, so really, we have about 150 stations that air the show, and many of them don't have a large Native listenership. But I'm telling you that story because as I was driving in today, a message showed up on my phone. For some reason, I didn't hear the phone go off. I guess I already had it muted because I was going to be speaking. And it was someone I'm working with in San Diego. They said, Dr. DeRose, bring your passport because I want to, you know, want you to go down to Mexico, and I'm not sure if that's all what's all on their agenda, but this is one of the people that is involved with funding the radio program. So I said, well, if they want me to go down to Mexico, I guess I'm going to be going down to Mexico. The point is, when I go to Mexico, I will be in an even more environmentally enriched situation than when I'm in San Diego. Why will that be? Yeah, I'll be out of my comfort zone. I don't speak much Spanish. And, you know, and I'll be in a different environment. Now you say, I'm glad I'm not going down there. I don't like to go down to Mexico. Others of you say, I wish I had, boy, speaking Spanish, oh, that's the, you know, the language of heaven. I wish I could be going with you, Dr. DeRose. Well, it doesn't matter what your reaction is. Environmental enrichment, new challenges. By the way, this is why classes are so powerful. You say, but Dr. DeRose, you know, this is kind of interesting what you're talking about, but I could have watched something more interesting than what you're talking about on the Discover Channel. You know, there's something, there's a special on CNN today. It was really interesting, and for some reason I came and I really missed out, and I'm listening to you instead. I find I get more out of what I can watch on my cable networks than I get when I come to church. Listen, you're missing the whole point. When you're sitting in your own home, you get nowhere near the benefit of when you're being exposed to new thoughts in a different venue. By the way, this morning I learned about, I actually heard rumors about this, but I just for the first time saw this here. Prophecy speaks hope in our world of uncertainty. And I was looking at this and I say, wow, you've got Chuck Holtry speaking. Chuck is really a great presenter. I don't know if you know Chuck. But he's doing this series of meetings. Now, some of you looked at this and you say, I'm not going to go to something. I'm not interested in that at all. Actually, those of you who are least interested in this kind of stuff, most need to come. You say, that's crazy, Dr. Rose. What are you talking about? Let me tell you two reasons why you need to come. One is, how many of you know Karen Hamilton and back? Okay, Karen, I'm giving her a gift. Because some of you are saying, we're getting cheated. This is a two-hour presentation, and our time's almost out. I can tell you're not finishing. Well, I'm going to give her two DVD sets, the whole Brain Health Revolution, and she's going to have them, and she's actually going to go to this meeting and make it more environmentally enriching. So if you're in this audience today, and you're one of the first two people to come to Karen, opening night, what is opening night? Friday, October 23rd. When is that? Wow, less than a week away. And you walk up to Karen, she's going to have these DVDs with her. And if she doesn't, you know, you're going to give you, Karen, what are you, no, she's going to have them with her and she'll give you, but you got to be one of the first, what? How many people? How many does she got? Two. So it'll make it even more environmentally enriching. So even if you think I overbilled Chuck, and I don't think you'll be disappointed. He's really a great presenter. I think you're going to enjoy it. But the point is, and I don't think we're going to have time to get to it here, but in this series, I talk about why Bible prophecy is good for brain health. Have you heard that one before? Why Bible prophecy is good for brain health? One of the reasons is it does this. It's environmentally enriching. But the other thing is, since we've just talked about stress, let me tell you this just a little bit. The federal government and the public health community is very concerned about stress.
And one of the big things in their radar screen is something called PTSD. How many of you have heard of PTSD? You know, I used to ask people about that, no hands went up. But now we've heard a lot about it. It stands for post-traumatic stress disorder. And you've probably heard about it because it's been popularized among our veterans. It's a big issue among people that have seen combat. But it's also a huge issue in the context of national disasters or natural disasters, whatever they might be. You can have national disasters that are not natural, as we well know. But the point is, when you are exposed to a traumatic event, you can come down with this condition. I actually, just this week, I had a patient in my office, bad PTSD. And he's kind of between mental health providers. I'm an internal medicine specialist. And so we're trying to help him before he can, you know, navigate the system and get into some, you know, the mental health care that he needs. And he came in with his significant other, and she was telling me he's having these terrible dreams about his mother dying in his arms and, you know, these various traumas that he had. He never was in combat. So the point is, we can have things happen in our life. But here's the interesting thing, and why I'm talking about Bible prophecy. A lot of people, I mean, they even look at this flyer. I'm just going to be honest with you. You look at this, and if you look carefully, you see, you know, like a person screaming. And if you look carefully, it looks like there might be some fire here, and looks like a tornado. And some people say, it's just a bunch of scary stuff. I don't go to stuff like that, because it's all scary. Just this week, I was seeing patients. It was 10:15 a.m. on Thursday. Do any of you know what happened? Did it happen where you were? They were having the largest supposed earthquake drill in the world. Did any of you take part in that? We were taking part of it at our clinic. And so at 10:15, they play, this is an earthquake, you know, take cover, you know, get, so, you know, we were supposed to all take cover and, you know, get under the table. I was at the time with someone who was in a wheelchair. I actually didn't pull him out of the wheelchair, you know, and throw him under, you know, one of the exam tables or something there in the clinic. But the point was, we were doing an earthquake drill. And you say, this is terrible. What were they doing? An earthquake. Could you think about... I'm gonna up the ante just a little bit. This is true. When I was a little kid, I mean little, you know what they did in my school? You know what terrible thing they did that could have traumatized hundreds of... Did they do it in your school too? I mean, how cruel. Fire drill. I mean, I never thought about there being a fire in school. And what? There's going to be a fire drill. What fire drill? Yes, if there's a fire in the school. What? A fire? I never thought about that as a kid. Now, isn't this terrible that we would have earthquake drills and fire? What do you think? Isn't this terrible? Shouldn't we try to sign a petition and have a law passed? Stop traumatizing our children. Stop having fire drills. How many of you would sign a petition like that? Okay, you don't like that. Why do we do that? It's preparation. Actually, here's what we find about PTSD. One of the things that prevents you from PTSD or decreases your risk of it, let me speak more precisely, is hazard preparedness. So why would you want to come to a meeting that may talk about some things that are scary? It's because it prepares you so when things, bad things do happen, you're more resilient. So I really recommend meetings like this, and I think it would be great to be there. And by the way, remember, the first two of you to come, find Karen, and you'll get the whole series. Well, some of you see what's up here. You say, well, Dr. DeRose, I know where this is going. Environmental enrichment, we talked a little bit about this. And we don't need to go through all the slides here because we don't have the time to. But I will tell you this. If you do activities that combine exercise, maybe even caloric restriction, and environmental enrichment, you can get the benefits of all of them. So let's say you're used to having a big evening meal. Well, skip the evening meal, go outside, and chop wood. Do you know that chopping wood or raking leaves or mowing the lawn is more environmentally enriching than walking on a treadmill? No, if a treadmill is the best you have, walk on the treadmill. That's better than, you know, sitting watching television. You get my point. But if you can get outside, it actually engages your mind. That's, by the way, that's stress relieving.
The fresh air will help you. Vitamin D from the sunshine. You get the picture. Well, last, and I won't take much time with it, we go into some detail with this in the DVD series. By the way, you just make friends, because I mean, two DVDs, you know, if you're the third person that sees Karen, don't get discouraged and leave Friday night. Just say, Karen, well, who were the two that got it? You see, and then sit by them Friday night. Okay, and if you weren't friends already, say, hey, you know, how about we get together sometime and we can watch the DVD together? You see, wouldn't that be a great thing to do? Yeah, you see how it works. Okay, so alcohol avoidance is on the list. And I'll just tell you, if we had the time to go through the material on this subject, I'll tell you that the public health community is pretty much in agreement. The less alcohol we drink, the better. Alcohol is not a health-giving factor. And some of you may have questions about that. But we probably will not be able to take a public question and answer session. But I am planning to stay by for a couple of things. I do have a presentation a little bit later this morning. Then there will be lunch, and I will be around at lunchtime. And if some of you have individual questions, I'll be more than happy to take those. You can even pull me off to the side anytime you see me and ask me questions.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.